Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Olubumi Bakari. This is our All Things Local series, where we highlight the local history, culture, communities, and personages who have made an impact on Washington, D.C. My guest today is George Derek Musgrove. Derek, you told me to call him Derek, is an assistant professor of history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He is the author of Rumor, Repression, and Racial Politics, How the Harassment of Black Elected Officials Shaped Post-Civil Rights America. And he's also the co-author of Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. Derek joins me today to discuss his book, Chocolate City, and our upcoming Black History Month program at the Juanita E. Thornton Shepherd Park Library, Black Migrations. And we'll talk about Black migrations to Washington, D.C. during the 19th and 20th century.
Yes.
Derek, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about you first. I want to get in you. You know, I want to know all about you. No, I'm just kidding. Tell me where you're from. Where did you grow up?
Sure. I grew up in Baltimore. Started coming to D.C. when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. Grabbed a friend of mine's ID. Mm-hmm. And headed over to the Ritz to go to hang out on the weekend.
On E Street?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Right across from FBI headquarters. Mm-hmm. And fell in love with the city back then. Mm-hmm. And so once I left graduate school, I moved here for good. Mm-hmm. I worked here for a quick minute. I lived over on Girard Street. Mm-hmm. in Columbia Heights. I lived here in, I think, 95 and 96, where I taught in the Sojourner Freedom School. Mm-hmm. But then I went to grad school and came back, and I've been back ever since.
Okay. And so why did you choose to study history?
You know, it was really a way of getting a better understanding of how I should act in the present. And so I had really admired, as a young person, W.E.B. Du Bois, but also Perrin Mitchell, who was the first African-American congressman from the state of Maryland. And they were both academics who took the information that they got in the library and in the archives and used it to try and help Black folks gain equality in the here and now. And I thought, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And so it was really just a question at that point of choosing an academic discipline. And because Du Bois was a historian, and because I liked telling stories, I went ahead and did history as well.
Mm-hmm. And so that was actually my next question. So you mentioned Du Bois, and you mentioned Perrin Mitchell.
Yes.
So who were some of the other historians who influenced you?
Well, you know, oddly enough, Yvonne von Sertima, who was a West Indian historian, I'm not even sure you'd call him a historian. He did quite literally everything, but he wrote a book called They Came Before Columbus.
Okay.
My mother gave it to me when I was in high school, mm-hmm. and I was so impressed by the breadth of information that he had collected to make his thesis. There are some times when I'm not sure that I completely agree with his thesis, but he was looking at everything from seed transfers to folk tales to burial practices to the question of whether or not a papyrus style raft could make it across the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these really diverse things that a single person should not be able to do by themselves. Mm-hmm. He had brought them all together in that book, and I was just, I was really struck by his curiosity and his ability to master new disciplines. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I had the good fortune to see him in person before he passed. I didn't speak to him, mm-hmm. But I was just, he was one of my inspirations as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm familiar with the book. in his work, his other works. So why do you feel like it's important to study the past?
Well, the past is probably the biggest body of data that we have out there for understanding the world around us, whether it's in archives or libraries, oral histories, which, you know, that are in people just walking around on the street. There's this massive trove of data that helps us understand how people act, why they act the way they do, what's come before, and what, by analyzing it, we can try and figure out what's probably coming after. And then there's, of course, in the stories of the past, inspiration for people who are trying to change the world today. And I think that's particularly apt for, someone who leans towards sort of liberal left African-American politics. Mm-hmm. And so I saw all that information, and I wanted to understand it. I wanted to know more. And the easiest way to do it and make a living was to do it as a practicing historian.
So what's liberal left? What would you consider to be liberal left?
I suppose we would call it social democratic. Mm-hmm. Someone who at the most conservative believes in a really robust liberal state that provides for folks' basic needs. Mm-hmm. As a way of generating a roughly egalitarian society. And I suppose at its left side, as someone who would actually advocate significant, although perhaps not total, worker ownership of the means of production.
Mm. Interesting. So I know as a historian, you strive to be objective, mm-hmm. in your works. Do you feel like, as a historian, that is challenging to, stay that middle road? Or would you find yourself leaning? Well, you just said something about being a liberal democratic, but even in telling stories, do you find that difficult to kind of stay in the middle and not sway one particular way?
Oh, sure. All historians strive for objectivity, mm-hmm. with a clear understanding, I would hope, that none of us will be able to achieve it perfectly. And so the code of ethics of the profession requires that you strive for it. And I think any good historian who is seeking truth, or at least the closest approximation of truth in our stories about the past that we can humanly achieve, strives for it. But I have a very clear understanding that the histories I write are not infallible. They're not a complete and objective rendering of the past. They're my argument about what I think the past looked like, mm-hmm. Based on the sources I was able to access. Mm-hmm. And then the hope when I put them out there, and this should be the hope of any historian, is that you engage in a robust argument about whether or not your interpretation was a good one with other historians and with the public that you're writing for.
Mm-hmm. So I want to switch gears a little bit and move on to your book, mm-hmm. Chocolate City. So the DC Public Library didn't have this platform for you to kind of come on and talk about it. So let's talk a little bit about that book. Now I've read in the introduction of the book that you were working at UDC and you had to come up with the DC history curriculum, which got scratched, which is where I know you from. I was a student then.
Okay.
I didn't take your course, any of your courses. Some of my friends did. But anyway, so that kind of shaped writing this book.
It got me involved in DC history. Mm-hmm. This was probably in my third or fourth year at UDC. Mm-hmm. I had a class that was canceled, and we had a policy that when your class is too small, it has to be canceled.
Right.
I was then assigned the DC history course, and it, of course, being assigned the course required that I actually learn DC history. And so a lot of the notes that I took for that class were kind of my basic introduction to the city's history. I had known a little bit. My first book, I had covered Marion Barry and Walter Fauntroy, but generally I didn't have a lot of background in the city's history. Working through the city's history with my students at UDC, some of whom I'm still in contact with, I really became quite fond of the city's history and wanted to know more. And it was in telling Chris Myers-Ash, who came to UDC about a year after that, after I taught that course, and telling him about, you know, my efforts to try and make this course my own. You know, it was in that conversation that he said, you know, we should write a book that you could have used in that class and that you would have liked to use in that class. And he sort of pulled me into the project. I mean, Chris is a DC native. He lived in Northwest, went to Deal and Wilson, already had a very strong love of the city. And so when I told him that there was a need, which is something that he already knew, I was just sort of, you know, bringing it to his attention again. He said, well, we've got to fill that need. Mm-hmm. And we went ahead and did that.
So who are some of the interesting characters that stood out to you while researching this book, Chocolate City?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there's so many. I'll say this and then I'll mention a few. We really wanted to make sure that the story was tangible and that people could relate to it within the population, not just among academics. Mm-hmm. And so we organized the entire story around places. Each chapter starts with a specific place in the city. And we identify them on a map in the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. And then the chapters are really propelled forward by people. And we try to give you some good background on these individuals and then sort of talk about how their lives illustrate what we want to argue in that specific chapter. I mean, there are any number of folks that we come across in the book that I'm quite enamored of. Probably one of my favorites is Walter Fauntleroy. You know, I'd known about him before I did the book, but I really came to admire him even more once I did the book. Fauntleroy is special, I think, for two reasons. One is that he really thought seriously about creating a sort of democratic organization that could run the city pretty much straight away. And so he was looking in the early 1970s to having his slate elect a majority of the elected officials in the entire city. The idea was to make that make the city really easy to govern from a political standpoint so that this coalition could then focus its efforts on gaining home rule and then after home rule, a vote in Congress for the district. And he built this pretty impressive machinery, along with members of the League of Women Voters and Common Cause and the NAACP, but this really impressive nationwide machinery where they advocated for DC statehood. And when they couldn't get it through, they took that machinery and used it for all of these remarkable purposes: sanctions against South Africa, mm-hmm. full employment legislation in the late 1970s, getting Democrats in a majority in the Senate in 1986, defeating Jefferson Sessions, who was up for a federal judgeship in 1985. And so there was really impressive campaigns that sort of grew out of Fauntleroy's remarkable political organizing locally. And I think particularly for a country that assumes D.C. is an afterthought, mm-hmm. That it's this politically powerless reserve, to see our non-voting delegate being able to put together a national organization that can pass national legislation was just remarkably impressive. And so I just really wanted to know more. And so I've been digging into his papers even more recently for my next book project.
Any others that stood out to you?
Sure, sure. Goodness, there was certainly Etta Horn, a welfare rights activist who worked out of Anacostia during the 1960s. You know, she really had the idea that you can't just walk into the Welfare Act office and beg, right? Mm-hmm. That in fact you have to go in there and demand a sort of a floor for the way people are going to live in this city. And we have to remember the context in which she's operating. The chair of the DC committee in the House of Representatives is a guy named John McMillan, the segregationist from South Carolina. And he loved to talk about how the welfare rolls were huge in D.C. People were really sort of out of control. The city's not functioning well. And then he would turn around and make sure that all those agencies that served poor people and folks who were receiving welfare didn't have enough money to do their job properly. Mm. The same for Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, who was the chair of the D.C. Appropriations Subcommittee in the Senate. And so they'd give these long-winded speeches about how, you know, D.C. was falling apart, and then they would make sure that the agencies that were supposed to alleviate the problem couldn't actually handle the problem, and then they turn around and complain about it again. Mm-hmm. And people like Etta Horn essentially called their bluff, right? Mm-hmm. So they would just march into the welfare office and say, you know, we need a furniture allowance. We don't want people coming in and peeking under our beds and looking for boyfriends and husbands and things like that nature. And, you know, essentially we want respect and we want resources. Through some very aggressive advocacy, I mean, some of which actually devolved into fights between police and some of her her co-activists, she was able to get a significant amount of resources for women who were trying to get on their feet using welfare in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm. This is really deep. So again, let's turn to Black Migrations, mm-hmm. which is this year's theme, DC Public Library's theme for Black History Month, which we follow ASALA, sure. Which is the Association for the Study of African American Life and History.
Yes. And everyone out there, academic and non-academic, please get your membership to ASALA. The founder of Black History Month, as well as the founder of ASALA, Carter G. Woodson, live right on 9th Street.
Yes.
And you should absolutely support that organization. I'm a member myself.
Yes, definitely. Most definitely. So before we talk about Black migrations, one of the things that I see in the library when we have students who come in for Black History Month, I never see any projects about Carter G. Woodson. Mm-hmm. And it's the same five individuals that, you know, the big five, you know, the Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and Harriet Tubman and so forth and so on. And there's so many other individuals who aren't talked about. And I went to a celebration last night. It was the 125th birthday of William Leo Hansberry. And they had a celebration for him. Now, I heard his name before, but I didn't know too much about him. And he was a professor at Howard University during the 1930s who really pushed for the study of African history. And this was kind of unheard of at the time. And he taught Kwame Nkrumah and Nnamdi Azikiwe, the first president of Nigeria, and Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana. So as a historian, you know, how can we, you know, push for, you know, to know more about other African Americans, you know, besides the other five? We need to know all these other historians. You mentioned Ivan Van Tertema. So how can we, I guess, make it broader, get these names out there so that students know more about, you know, these other contributions from other people in African history?
Sure, sure. Well, I think that one of the problems that we face is that the way that we teach African-American history, particularly on the primary school level, is that we value physical struggle, I think, above other types of struggle in who we decide to choose to feature, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Martin Luther King is arrested a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. Rosa Parks doesn't give up her seat. You know, you can kind of go on down the list. Frederick Douglass has a fight with his master before he eventually escapes for freedom, etc. And so you don't get as much attention to people who do primarily intellectual labor, right? And that intellectual labor is just as important as the physical struggle because, of course, you need to, you're fighting over ideas, right? And Carter G. Woodson doesn't have that sort of flashbulb moment where he's struggling with a racist in the street. Mm-hmm. But he devotes an entire life to building a lasting and important African-American organization, ASALA. He is able to focus the country's attention through constant intellectual labor, and that's with the creation of Negro History Week, later to become Black History Month, about 50 years after he founds it. And through his, you know, absolutely itinerant life of just spreading the gospel of African-American history, he's able to, you know, create sort of a space for African-Americans to celebrate their history in a country that actively argued that Black people had no history worth celebrating, much less worth even knowing. And so I think part of what we just have to do is make sure that we communicate to our children that other types of labor for Black freedom is just as important. And, within D.C. just itself, mm-hmm. you look at the roster of remarkable African-American educators, mm-hmm. and you got to think we got to do a better job, right? You got, Rayford Logan at Howard University, Alain Locke at Howard University, Nanny Helen Burroughs founding her school over on the other side, east of the river, Mary Church Terrell, who was a high school teacher, Anna Julia Cooper, who was a high school principal, all in Washington, D.C., and that's, of course, on top of Carter G. Woodson.
Kelly Miller.
I mean, we could go on, right? And people like, we have to remember, too, that, people like Carter G. Woodson wrote one of only four high school level textbooks on African-American history published by African-Americans at the turn of the century, right? And that means, essentially, that most young people in this city, their first taste of African-American history in written form is probably coming through his hand. I mean, that is no small thing. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, we got to do a better job of focusing people's attention on those folks as well.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. So back to the theme of Black migrations, let's talk about it nationally before we focus in on D.C.
Sure.
So in your opinion, what are some of the contributions that African-American immigrants with an E have made to some of the cities that they migrated to?
Well, if I could, let me step back and make the case that, when we talk about African-American migrations, mm-hmm. we're talking about a lot of different movements, right? You have mm-hmm. the transatlantic slave trade, which brings 500,000 African-Americans to the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries. Mm-hmm. The 17th and 18th centuries. You have the interstate slave trade, which brings approximately 1 million African-Americans from this area, from the Chesapeake and the Tidewater, down into the Mississippi Valley, and really moves the center of the African-American population towards the Cotton Belt South. You then have the first and second Great Migrations, which most people think of mm-hmm. When they talk about a great African-American migration, and that moves about 6 million African-Americans out of the South and into the cities of the North. As that is happening, by the way, large numbers of African-Americans are moving from the rural areas of the South to the cities of the South. And so another aspect of the Great Migration, North and South, mm-hmm. is that the Black population goes from being significantly rural to about 80% urban, mm-hmm. right, by the time we get to about 1970. And then today you actually have a migration of African-Americans out to the suburbs in significant numbers. And you also have large numbers of Africans and West Indies coming to the United States, right? So you can say there's Black folks stay on the move, right? Now, what do they do when they move? And you're talking specifically about the great Migration. I think one of the main things that they do is that they nationalize what was a Southern phenomenon. In 1910, roughly 90% of the Black population is in the South. It's in the states of the old Confederacy. By the time that you get to the 1960s and 70s, over half are outside of the South. Mm-hmm. And so the main thing that the Great Migrations do is that they nationalize the race problem, as Alain Locke said in his book, The New Negro, in 1925. That's actually important because by heading into northern cities, African-Americans in Detroit, in New York, in Baltimore, in Kansas City can say to their elected representatives and in these places where they can actually vote, I actually care about what's going on in Mississippi where Black folks can't vote. I care about what's going on in the Alabama Black Belt where Black folks can't vote. And I need you to care about it, too, or I'll vote someone else into office. Mm-hmm. And so it's that pressure that starts to create a sort of liberal northern constituency or reinforces, gives a spine to a liberal northern constituency that's primarily white, mm-hmm. That begins to push for civil rights reforms in the early to mid-20th century. And that would grow over time as African Americans push harder and harder, and more end up in these northern cities where they're able to elect people like Adam Clayton Powell, Mr. Civil Rights from Harlem, or Charlie Diggs from Detroit, who goes to Mississippi and sits in on the Emmett Till murder trial, right? And so you can see how that movement of African Americans north eventually comes to affect conditions back in the South. And so I'd say that, because I'm a political historian especially, that's one of the biggest effects that I see.
So what effects did it have on the economy, the U.S. economy?
That's a big question. So I think a better way to put it is what effects did the economy have on migration? African Americans are, during the first and second great migrations, chasing jobs. You know, the South is a rough place to be if you're black, you know, after the fall of Reconstruction, so from the 1870s onward. And yet, African Americans stay in the South, by and large, well into the 19-teens, right? And the logical question for us would be, well, why, right? The reason is because they simply don't have access to a good source of jobs outside the South. And so you can move and you get worse weather, you move away from family, you move away from the land that you know, troubled though it may be, to a place where you likely won't be able to get any better of a job than you have back home. I mean, the industrial economy prior to World War I is almost entirely closed to African Americans outside the South, right? And so once World War I cuts off European immigration and requires Northern industry to recruit African Americans, then you see the floodgates open. And, you know, just within 5 years, 500,000 black folks move north during World War I. And about 700,000 more move north in the 20s, which are, of course, boom years for American industry. And so that is specifically because the northern economy is opening up to African Americans because there's a labor shortage, right? The same thing happens during World War II. Again, jobs open up in all of these northern factories, and African Americans come out of the South to do so. Now, the other reason they're doing that is because the economy of the South is changing. The New Deal legislation of Franklin Delano Roosevelt makes money available to Southern farmers who use it to buy tractors. And with tractors, they're able to put black sharecroppers out of work. You know, you add to this a couple of natural disasters, the boll weevil infestation of the 1920s, the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, the Great Depression in and of itself. And the rural areas are just places where black folks don't really have any likelihood of getting ahead, much less in certain cases surviving, right? And so they go to places where they think that they may be able to do one or the other, hopefully both. And for many, that means, you know, north, or for those people who are coming out of places like Louisiana and Texas, it means out west, to places like L.A.
Now, what about Chocolate City, Washington, D.C., specifically?
Sure. So, you know, D.C. sees two really large migrations of African Americans in its history. The first one is during the Civil War. There are about 14,000 African Americans in D.C. On the eve of the Civil War in 1860. By the time you get to 1870, there are about 43 or 44,000. So the black population increases by 30,000. The actual number of people who came into the city is actually a bit larger than that. But they come in from the plantation districts of Virginia and Maryland, sometimes as far south as the Carolinas. And they're coming here because D.C. is, of course, the first place to end slavery within its borders with the D.C. Emancipation Act of 1862, but also because they felt more secure, closer to the flag, to paraphrase them. You know, the reason that I say that there were more coming in than actually ended up being here is because they're coming into a city with a white Democratic government who does not want them here, and who makes absolutely no provision for their survival. And so many of them sleep out in the elements. Many die. There are, you know, sort of epidemics that sweep through what people call the contraband camps of the Civil War. But nonetheless, about 30,000 survive, and you have this significant black population by 1870. That then feeds on itself because that population is not only large in their security in numbers, but it also becomes quite politically powerful. Mm-hmm. It is able, by getting the vote, the Negro Suffrage Act of 1866 enfranchises black male D.C. residents, and they're able to elect a Republican mayor in 1868, an abolitionist named Sayles Bowen. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he knows that he owes his election to them and tries to channel resources to them. At the same time, the Freedmen's Bureau is here, mm-hmm. And they are channeling resources to African-Americans as well, really to make sure that they're able to live, that they're able to work, and that they're able to rise in society. And so General O.O. Howard, the head of the Freedmen's Bureau, establishes a Negro university at the nation's capital, which of course becomes Howard University. And he also buys land out on the other side of the river in Berry's farm, mm-hmm. And then sells it to African Americans with very low interest loans and building supplies. And so you get black land ownership on the other side of the river. You also have these contraband camps that essentially turn into black neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so there are little black settlements around like Fort Stevens and Fort DuPont and all these other neighborhoods around the city become black neighborhoods later on. And so black folks are getting access to land. They're getting access to education. And they are, for a very short period of time, just through the early 1870s, gaining access to political power. Mm-hmm. But that's attractive to African-Americans from the rural districts who really aren't getting much of any of that. And so the migration continues into D.C. all the way through, in pretty significant numbers, all the way through the 1890s. And by the mid-1890s, D.C. has the largest urban African-American population in the country and is widely considered, because of all of the learning and wealth here, to be the capital of black America.
And in the 20th century...
Yeah. So in the 20th century, we see this, the first great migration bypassing D.C. You know, the first great migration is an industrial migration. It's for people who are heading to factories in cities that are feeding the war machine in World War I. D.C. doesn't have those factories. And its big growth industry during World War I is really sort of white-collar work in the federal government, clerkships and things like that. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that Woodrow Wilson had... allowed his deputies and his agency heads to institute segregation in the federal bureaucracy right on the eve of World War I. Mm-hmm. So even though there's this pretty significant expansion of government work during World War I, there's not a particularly large expansion of African-American employment. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing pulling African-Americans into the city, and you don't really see a significant uptick in black migration into the city. Where you start to see it is after the war. And It increases, you know, relatively quickly across the 20s and 30s. But in the 40s, it really sort of jumps into a flood. In the 40s, you get about 100,000 new African-American residents. In the 50s, you get another 100,000 African-American residents. And you get a black population that goes from about 190,000 in 1940 to well over 400,000 in 1960. And so it more than doubles. Mm-hmm. And that's really what turns D.C. into Chocolate City, because as African-Americans are flooding into the city, because they can't go to the suburbs, are segregated,
right.
White D.C. residents are flooding out, mm-hmm. Because, one, the suburbs are a really nice place to buy a house and with a little yard and have some good brand-new schools, and the federal government is subsidizing that, mm-hmm. through low-interest loans backed by the Federal Housing Administration. But more importantly... large numbers of white D.C. residents realize that the federal government is no longer interested in protecting segregation in the nation's capital. And so, before you even have the desegregation of schools in 1954 with Bowling v. Sharp, which was a companion case to Brown v. Board, you had a black population that's growing exponentially, a white population that's shrinking. And the way that the local school board dealt with that, because you still had a segregated school system, mm-hmm. was that it was... consistently transferring white schools into the black school system because there were so many more black students, so many fewer white students. And a lot of white parents and white students just really found this to be abhorrent. I mean, you know, particularly when they transferred Central, mm-hmm. Which is now Cardozo. Mm-hmm. And they just said, look, you guys aren't trying to protect us. We're out of here. And so there's a pretty significant drop in the white population even before Brown versus Board is decided. After it's decided, I mean, it really jumps. So 170,000 white residents leave D.C. in the 1950s alone. It's actually lower in the 1960s. I think we tend to think of white migration out of the city as, well, you know, you had the riots in 68 and then all the white people left. But before the riots, well, more than a quarter of a million white residents had already left the city by the time the riots actually pop off. Mm-hmm. And so it's a much more complicated story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everyone should go and check out A Right to the City. That's at the Anacostia Museum. They're about to close in, I think, a week or two for renovations, and then they'll open up again in the fall. But you should check that out because as you were talking about white flight, I was thinking of a picture that's actually in the Anacostia section, and they have like three different photos of Sousa Middle School.
Yes.
And so you have one right before the Bowling v. Sharp case and the Brown versus Board of Education case. And then as soon as that goes through, you see like four black students. And then the next year it's like half black. And then the next year is like, they're gone.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so it's interesting that you mentioned that. So that kind of goes along with that.
And one thing I should add, I mean, I think a lot of your listeners, like most people in DC, assume that Anacostia has always been has always had a very large black population. And prior to 1950, the black population east of the river is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
You've got black folks living in Hillsdale, which we
which
is essentially the Berry Farms area.
Right.
And you also had them in Deanwood. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much it. You know, the East River population is you know, somewhere in the area of 80% white, you know, in 1950. By 1970, it's the inverse.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 85% black. And that's because the working class and middle class white population east of the river just left.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that was because the neighborhood was really flooded with people who were escaping urban renewal in Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a solid 10,000 people from Southwest end up east of the river after urban renewal, which happens in the mid-1950s.
Right.
But nonetheless, the demographic change is really quite jarring.
Mm-hmm. So, if you want to hear more about black migrations, we have a program that's coming up on Thursday. It's at the Juanita E. Thornton Shepherd Park Library. It's going to be at 7 p.m. And Derek is our keynote speaker.
It is going to be amazing.
It's going to be lit. Literature. No, just kidding. Okay, so we are going to begin to wrap up the show. But before I end, I do this thing that I call Fast Five, where I ask my guests five questions, and you give me the first thing that pops into your head.
Uh-oh. All right.
So my first question is kind of interesting. So I saw you at a concert last year. You were looking quite professorial. So I was like, why is he here? What is he doing here? So once I ask you this question, you're going to know which concert I'm talking about. But who is your favorite MC, Mos Def or Talib Kweli?
I refuse to choose. I don't think you can choose. I was at the Black Star show. I was also there to see Dead Prez. And
which was on 420. But anyway.
Yes. And I saw Black Star's. I was at Black Star's album release party in New York.
Okay.
In 1997. And I got my life then. And then when they came to Anthem, I got my life then, too.
Okay. So you refuse to answer the question.
You can't choose.
Okay. I'll take that. which historian, dead or alive, would you like to meet, have lunch with?
Oh God, it would have to be Du Bois. Although I'd be scared because he was a towering intellect, and he did not. I don't get the sense from what I've read about him that he was particularly willing to deal with anyone who wasn't on their P's and Q's. And so I'd have to prep.
Okay. What's your favorite DC restaurant? Even though I know you like to cook.
Yes.
Bacon.
Lots of bacon. You know, it was the Italian restaurant that was just down the block from here. It has since closed. My wife and I love that place, Pasta Mia. Mm-hmm. But that's open, oh, goodness, I guess somewhere between Habaneros and Duquem.
Okay. Fancy. what is your favorite historical landmark in D.C.?
Probably the Civil War, Black Civil War Memorial on U and I think it's Vermont. It's you know I think it brings home the fact that there were real live people just emerging from slavery in many instances who fought to make democracy real for this country and certainly for their posterity. And I am I'm thankful that they did.
Mm-hmm. Last question. What would you like for your legacy to be?
That I wrote a few good books and that my kids think I was a good dad.
Oh, that's cute. Well, thank you, Derek. Thank you for joining me today.
That was the puff question, huh?
That I was a good dad.
And I like puppies, too.
Yeah. Thank you. And again, please come out to hear Derek speak. Juanita E. Thornton, Shepherd Park Library, 7 o'clock p.m. Of course, he'll be talking about black migrations
yes.
in Washington, D.C. This has been an episode of DCPL's All Things Local on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Please visit dclibrary.org to learn more about the library's programs and services. Talk to us online at DCPL or on Twitter at DC Public Library. Also Instagram too, at DC Public Library. Listen and download the show wherever you listen to your podcast by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.